want to talk actually about several things tonight and tomorrow night, both from themes from Money and Greed and God, and then my new book, The Human Advantage, which actually just came out this summer. So I'm going to start actually with this question of what I'm going to call free enterprise. Many of you, I hope by the end of the night, if you're wondering, can you hear me, by the way? I want to make sure the mic works. How's it doing? I don't feel like it's really quite. How's that? Is it better? Can you turn it up at all? Yeah, it just doesn't sound very loud. I can hear myself fine, but I don't feel like this is really projecting. Not that great back there? Okay, let's pull it up some more. Only I didn't have a chin, this would actually be much better. All right, how's that? Okay, that's better. And I can actually talk louder too. Most people, if you actually ask them to define the word capitalism or where the word capitalism came from, very few people actually know. Believe it or not, capitalism is a word that was popularized by Karl Marx. It's actually a Marxist word. If you read Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, which is sort of the foundational book of modern market economics, it's written in 1776, he doesn't know the word capitalism. He doesn't use it. You will not find any of the American founders using the word capitalism. Capitalism was a word that was popularized in the 19th century by Karl Marx, and for whatever reason, we ended up adopting it to refer to a system of economic freedom where you have private property and limited government and rule of law and economic freedom. We just adopted the word. And that happens sometimes. A pejorative word that's actually developed or popularized by a critic of an idea will end up getting used. That's what happened with the word Christian. The first people that used Christian in Antioch, it was sort of used as a pejorative, and we ended up just calling, okay, well, that's a good word. I guess we'll just use that. That's what happened with capitalism. And the problem is that if you ask people, like, do this yourself, okay, even if you're sort of straight thinking already on economics, try to think, what's the mental picture that pops into your mind when you hear the word capitalism? Now, I ask college students this, and almost universally, the same mental image is if implanted in them from birth is that tuxedoed, mustachioed guy from the Monopoly game. Right. His name is Uncle Pennybags. You might not know, the game Monopoly was actually developed by an American socialist who was hoping, she was hoping that Americans would turn against what she thought of as evil capitalism. Americans ended up loving the game and never did really get the lesson. It didn't work. But that mental image of a kind of rich guy in a suit that takes people's money and lives just for money, that sort of lives on. And so that gets associated with the word capitalism. And so I've gone back and forth for a long time. I felt like, okay, I'm going to try to redeem this word. And then finally I thought, let's just use a better word. And so I now really prefer to talk about free enterprise. But we're talking about the same thing. If you look up in the dictionary the word capitalism, you'll get more or less this idea of free enterprise. And I actually think that if you don't ever actually have to have a course in economics to think fairly clearly about economic subjects. If you don't just sort of trust your initial intuitions, but learn to recognize certain myths that we all pick up. Because the weird thing about the economic realm is that it's kind of counterintuitive. In other words, things happen in the economic realm that you might not expect. So for instance, people can do things that mean to help people in the economic realm. You do it and you want to help someone, and you harm them. And sometimes people can do things for greedy reasons that are actually beneficial to people. That's weird. It doesn't seem like it should line up that way, but that's what often happens in the market. And so you have to learn to sort of think about the nature of economic reality. Because it's only once you do that that you can really ask any kind of questions about, say, should we raise the minimum wage? Or should we have tariffs? Or should we have government-funded health care? These kinds of questions. You don't actually know how to answer that question if you don't have any idea what's going to happen if you do that. And so, but unfortunately, we very often will just immediately jump to a conclusion about this without actually knowing anything about it. That's the weird thing about economics. If I was going to talk about, say, chemistry, right? Now, nobody would be here, obviously, but let's assume I had lied to you, right? We're going to talk about chemistry. You would know, well, to talk about chemistry, you need to know at least that there's a periodic table of the elements, that there are these elements, and hydrogen is the lightest element and helium, and there's a bunch of others, right? There's kind of basic realities, basic truths that you would need to know if you were going to say anything meaningful about chemistry, right? It seems obvious. Same thing with physics. Economics isn't like that. People treat economics as if there's no reality to it. There's just all kind of competing political ideologies, and there's no actual truths out there. And that's really the kind of biggest mistake that we would make. And this is why I think it's actually really hard to integrate ethics and economics. She's the person initially confused by this question, because it's actually really baffling. For instance, you might, if you don't distinguish three different kinds of questions, get yourself completely confused about an economic policy that is actually really easy to understand. And the reason it's hard to think both about ethical questions that we'll want to ask as Christians, I mean, the reason most of us are interested in economic questions, I can tell you about college students, if they take an economics class, most of the time it's because they think, well, I want to find out why some people are poor and some people are rich. I want to find out why some countries succeed and others don't. Maybe I want to go into development work and missionary work and I want to help people in Haiti. Right? So that's what they actually go into studying economics for moral reasons. Right? In fact, I've never met anyone that said, well, I really wanted to get clear on comparative advantage and Coase's theorem. Right? No, that's not where kids start out. They're actually interested in it for moral reasons. But this can be an impediment. And the reason is because there are three different kinds of questions that you need to ask and distinguish in order to think about these things clearly. The first one is just the what question. Now, the what question is just what happens out there in the world. So I'm just going to use an example. Let's say that somebody proposes, a politician, maybe one of those politicians we saw a picture of a minute ago, that the federal government should raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour. So everyone will be rich, right? And it sounds nice. And improbably, all members of Congress say, well, that sounds nice. And so they agree to it. They vote on a bill in the House and the Senate. It goes to the president. The president signs it. And we raise the federal minimum wage to $100 an hour. So now it's illegal for anyone to hire anyone for any kind of job unless they pay them at least $100 an hour. All right, so you got the scenario? The what question is what would happen if we did that? This is not rocket science, like I said, right? What is going to happen if we do that? Now, I'm telling you, 95% of the problems we get into in economics come from not stopping and asking this question. Because what are we assuming here? Anyone that proposes that, they're thinking, well, we'll raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour, and then everyone will have a job in which they make at least $100 an hour, so we'll be rich. That's what they're assuming, right? But we don't know that's what's going to happen, do we? In fact, every economist you ask will tell you, no, that's not what's going to happen. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. All right. And in fact, this is the first thing you learn in economics is what prices do and the relationship between supply and demand. All right. But the what question, I don't want to get ahead of myself, is just what would happen. So imagine we try this a bunch of times and we say, okay, we're going to raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour. Now let's look at, say, unemployment rates before and after. Let's look at what happens to domestic industry and outsourcing of industry and offshoring and things like that. Let's look and see what happens to, say, young minority teenage boys in inner cities that have never gotten a job. And then we test it. So the what question is just going to be what would happen. All right? So now you notice you can ask and presumably answer that question without asking whether you should do it. Just what would happen. Now, I could tell you, but I'd get ahead of myself, what would happen if we actually did that. But all I want you to see is that's a particular kind of question. Now, the second question is the why question. So the what question is what would happen. The why question is, well, now, why did that happen? Now, I can tell you what would happen if we raised the minimum wage to $100 an hour. And everyone in Congress knows this. This is why no one ever proposes $100 minimum wage increases. Now think about this just for yourself. You might now have the skills in a particular time and place, maybe in Billings, you know, different types of skills and labor and jobs have different values to people, right? If you have never had a job and actually don't even know how to show up on time, the value of your labor just is going to be fairly low. In fact, it's very unlikely that your labor is worth $100 an hour to anyone, right, in that case. But if you're saying ophthalmologist, it's really good at reattaching retinas and you're the only one in the state, right? Your labor as an ophthalmologist may be worth hundreds of dollars an hour. You see? And notice this isn't based on any kind of subjective thing. Well, you know, let's just sort of decide how much these things are going to be worth. It has to do with what people actually need and want. And so your labor is going to be worth whatever it is, depending on where you are, what your skills are, what needs to be done, and those kinds of things, right? And then you try to find a good match for that. But you can't make somebody's labor worth more than $100 an hour by making it illegal for anyone to pay them less. Think about it. You can't make someone's labor worth $100 an hour just by making it illegal for someone to pay them anything less. If your labor's worth, say, $10 an hour, greeting someone at the local hamburger place, telling an employer, to hire that guy, you're going to have to pay him $50 an hour. Are you going to hire him? Of course not, unless you're like, well, you know, let's figure out how to lose a bunch of money every day. So you're either not going to hire him, or you're going to cut back, right? And so the reason, interestingly, you know where minimum wage legislation first started in the United States? As a racist policy, because whites did not like blacks being able to compete with them. And so they thought, well, let's raise the minimum wage because I'm white. And so think of this as 1910, and you're in Oregon, which is where this got really popular. And white union workers thought, well, we don't want at the time, the much poorer black neighbors on the other side of town to be able to compete with us. So let's raise the minimum wage so that those lower skilled workers that are willing to take a much lower wage won't be able to get jobs. That was the point of the law. And nobody that supports minimum wage does it for that reason now, obviously. Right? But that was the whole point, is that you want to price certain workers out of the market. Right? So that just is what it is because of what prices do and supply and demand. So what I've done is I've told you, so what would happen is you'd end up with massive unemployment and almost no one would end up with a legal job before long. People would still have jobs, but suddenly what the legal market would become the so-called black market. So people would just start paying each other and hiring each other off books to get around the law. That's what would happen. All right, so you'd end up with massive official unemployment and a massive black market. Now you can do this over and over and know, okay, that's what happens, but not know why it happens. You need to know a little economic theory to know why it happens, and I've actually done that just now, seamlessly. I've talked about what prices do, I've talked about the economic value of labor, I've talked about supply and demand. If you're the only ophthalmologist in town, and there's a bunch of people with detached retinas, right? There's a high demand, and there's a very low supply, and so your labor's gonna fetch a lot of money. Those are economic realities that are out there, that are part of reality just as much as the periodic table of the elements. Now, they're not about chemistry. They're about this mysterious economic realm, this social realm of human interaction, and we've discovered them. These are things that economists actually know. Now, the third question is what ought? In other words, what ought we to do? This is the moral question. Now, notice this is a totally different kind of question. It's not what's going to happen, and it's not, well, why did that happen? It's should we do this or not? Now, here's the key point. How could you possibly answer the third question if you don't know the answer to the first and second question? Right? If you literally have no idea what's going to happen if we raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour, on what possible basis could you say that we should do it? So in other words, if we want to know what to do when it comes to economics and economic policy, if we want to know what kind of system, economic system that we want to have or ought to have, we need to know something about economic reality. Does that make sense? It's really, really simple, but believe it or not, this is where almost all of the confusion lies when it comes to thinking about economics, is that people don't understand, oh, I really need to know something about reality, about things we've discovered, things that have been learned over the last couple of hundred years, for instance. And this is what actually led me to write this book, Money, Greed, and God, because I had taken a micro and a macroeconomics course in college. I had started out very much on the left side of the spectrum, at least not on life issues, but on economic issues when I was in college, because I started out my freshman year reading the Communist Manifesto for a political science course, got myself thoroughly confused and sort of thought of myself as a Christian socialist for a while, but I kept reading people like Thomas Sowell so that by the time of my senior year, I was convinced, market economies are very much the way to go. I mean, for the things you want an economy to do. Now, this is in the late 1980s, right before the collapse of the Soviet Union. And so I finally sort of worked my way out of this bad thinking. But then the Soviet Union collapsed, and I thought, well, this debate is settled. finally. And some of you may remember in the early 1990s, everyone agreed that socialism was bad. Virtually everyone. If you go back and listen to President Bill Clinton talk about these things, he talks about markets, he talks about competition, he talks about lowering trade barriers. That was Bill Clinton, all right? That's changed. And so what I discovered speaking on Christian college campuses around 1999 or 2000 is that the same bad ideas in economics I had in my head 10 years before were alive and kicking 10 years later. Now we're 25 years later, and you know what's happened? Socialism, it's not just kind of reared its head quietly, it is being endorsed publicly and nationally by name. And that's because people now vote that have no memory of the Cold War. They have no knowledge whatsoever of the awful history of the Soviet Union and of communism that we'll talk about in the second talk tonight. And so that's why this stuff has to be talked about. The good news is that you don't have to actually take macroeconomics and microeconomics. In fact, how many of you have had the macroeconomics course from college? But that course, I'm convinced, is designed to prevent you from liking economics. That's the only thing I can figure out. It's like to alienate people from economics, because you end up not learning economic reasoning more often than not when you take that course. And I realized, okay, I'm going to start talking about this, and college students constantly had all these objections about capitalism, free markets, and things that they said about socialism that were completely wrong. And I thought, oh my word, there's like 1,000 misconceptions. So I started writing them down. Thought you'd have to write an encyclopedia to respond to all this stuff. But after a while, you know what I discovered? Is that all their ideas consolidated into 8 basic ideas, 8 basic myths that people believe about the economy, about wealth and poverty, about free enterprise. And if you learn to recognize those myths in your thinking and the thinking of others, you can actually see your way through to most economic dilemmas. And I'm actually convinced if you learn these myths, you'll think more clearly about economics than 95% of the population. Right? And that's surely worth something. And it's certainly good news. I'm not going to give you all 8 myths tonight, but let me give you 4 so that you kind of get a flavor of what I'm talking about. The first and most important one is what I call the piety myth. The piety myth is basically confusing the goodness of your intentions with the actual effects of your actions. Confusing what you mean to do with what you actually do. You can see how this relates to what we talked about a minute ago. There's a great little book called Economics in One Lesson by a guy named Henry Hazlitt, written in the 1950s. And right at the beginning of the book, he talks about what he calls the art of economics. Not the science of economics, but the art of economics. Think about it as a kind of a disposition. If you acquire a particular artistic skill, it's something you learn by habit, right? You sort of get it down in your bones. Here's what he says. So the art of economics consists in looking not merely at the immediate, but at the longer effects of any act or policy. It consists in tracing the consequences of that policy, not merely for one group, but for all groups. In other words, to master the art of economics, if your friend says, let's raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour, and then everyone will be rich, you won't snap at her, ideally, right? But you also just won't say, oh, that's a great idea. You'll just say this, oh, that's nice, and then what would happen? It's that simple. And then what would happen? In other words, okay, that sounds nice, but let's think about what do you think is going to happen if we do that? And then just trace the consequences, not for the one person who's was due for a raise and already making $99 an hour, but for the vast majority of people whose labor won't be worth that much, right? That's the art of economics. And if you learn to do that, you can overcome the piety myth. The reason I call this the piety myth is piety has to do with the state of our hearts, right? And so the piety myth is sort of focusing on our intentions, on the goodness of our motives, rather than on what we actually do. Now, the reason that we have a hard time, I think, with this as Christians is because we know that both why we do something and what we do matter morally. God cares both what we do and why we do it, right? I mean, that's part of the point of the widow's mites, which we hear about in a couple of different places in the Gospels, right? Jesus and the disciples are in the temple in Jerusalem. Most of you, I'm sure, remember this story. And people, you know, rich people are showing up with all of their offerings and gold and jewels, and they're quite flagrantly and ostentatiously giving their offerings to the temple. And then Jesus catches a humble widow with 2 mites, so essentially 2 copper pennies, going up and placing her offering. And he calls her out above everyone else. What does he say? He says that her gift was greater than everyone else's gifts. Now, does Jesus not know how to count? Right? Is he saying, oh, well, there was a capital campaign and we were just about to fulfill it and the last 2 cents just came in? No, that wasn't his point, right? His point was that morally, all the people with all of their great wealth were giving out of their wealth. They weren't actually really sacrificing anything. Moreover, they were benefiting because they were being seen giving big gifts. But the widow actually had to both give out of her poverty, so presumably maybe her last 2 copper pennies, and she had to act with humility. That would be humiliating if that's all you had, and yet she did it. And so morally, what she did was more significant than all the others. Jesus' point was here, was that the moral significance of the act was greater for the widow than for all the other people who gave much greater gifts. Right? So God cares both why you do and what you do. Why you do it and what you do. He wants to know there's a connection between the external and the internal. Think how intimately connected these are. Imagine I give my wife 2 dozen roses. It's not her birthday, it's not our anniversary. I haven't really done anything, I haven't wrecked her car and not told her about it. She just gets 2 dozen roses for me, and you hear about it, and she tells you about it, and you think, gosh, that is so nice. Your husband just does these randomly kind things. But my friend actually knows something else. He knows that I like to go on 3-day golf outings, and my wife hates me to go on 3-day golf outings, and I want to go on one again next week. And I haven't told her about it yet. And just before that, I give her these 2 dozen roses. Now, does that change the moral character, your sort of estimation of the act, right? My friend's going to know he's just trying to grease the skids. He's manipulating her, right? The same act completely changes his moral character based on the motive. That's true of the moral life. That's not true in economics. The reason a member of Congress votes on a bill bears no relation to what the effect of the bill actually is. They just do not connect. And in fact, focusing on what we mean to do when it comes to economic policy actually distracts us. We're more likely, in fact, not to focus on the actual effects, because that's really what matters. Now, yeah, maybe for the state of your soul, I hope members of Congress are doing things for the right reasons. But what we want them to do is to do the right things for the right reasons. And frankly, if I had to have a choice, I'd rather have legislators that do the right thing for wrong reasons. Bad for them, but at least it's better for everyone else, right? That's the sort of genius of the best kind of political system, is you want a system that kind of works even when scoundrels are in office, right? That's actually what you want. And so you don't want a system that requires that there always be an alignment between these things. Now, I call this the piety myth after a quote by the 20th century French philosopher Etienne Gilson, who put the point this way. He said, piety is no substitute for technique. So in other words, if you're going to have open heart surgery, you might like to have a Christian doctor, right? You might like to know that he's a Christian and that maybe he goes to your church and he prays before surgery, right? But let's say you knew that, but you also knew that he was really bad at surgery, right? That he was just all thumbs, right? And the other doctor in town was an atheist who's also the top-rated surgeon in the country. Now, who are you going to go to? Right? It's like, sorry, I know we're friends, but I'm going with this guy. You see the point? Is that your piety, the piety of the doctor, doesn't substitute for this actual skill of successfully working on hearts. All right? That was Gilson's point. And just because you mean well doesn't mean that you might not advocate and support and vote for a policy that'll kill people. Literally. That's actually possible when it comes to economic policy. And so you want to know what's actually going to happen. Let me give you a couple of examples of this. Rent control. I'm sure there's no rent control in Billings, but rent control was a popular policy, especially in the 1970s, in large cities, places like New York and Oakland, California. And so what people noticed in cities, it was sort of the bitter end of the sort of industrialization and urbanization that started about 1900, people moving from the country to the cities. And so these very large urban areas started, you know, they're limited in terms of the amount of space they have. Like the Manhattan Island is a narrow, skinny little island. There's only so much space there. And so if a lot of people want to live there and there's limited space, you know, think about supply and demand. So limited supply, increase in demand, price is going to go up, right? And so politicians noticed that very quickly they realized actually lower income people are getting priced out of housing in our area unless we do something about it. And sort of universally around the world, city councils thought, well, let's just implement rent control. In other words, we'll just put a ceiling on how much landlords are allowed to charge for rent. So rent control would basically be you tell all the people that, say, own one-bedroom apartments that they can't charge more than, say, $400 a month for rent. So the idea is that you'll keep the price down where people can afford it. So that's the intention. Do you know what actually happens whenever these kinds of policies are implemented? It creates a shortage in just the housing that was meant to be protected. And you can figure this out just by thinking about it from the perspective of the landlord. Let's say you own a 10-story apartment complex and all one-bedroom apartments, and it costs you $800 a month just to maintain every single individual apartment. And now the city's told you you can only charge $400 a month. That means if you rent it out, you're going to lose $400 a month in every unit. Right? That makes absolutely no sense. You're going to do that? Not, again, unless you want to lose a lot of money. And so what are you going to do? Well, sort of one of three main things you can do. You can convert it to condominiums, so it's not rental property. This happened to my wife and me when we first moved to Seattle. We were in an apartment. Suddenly they decided to convert it to condos. Turns out we couldn't afford it. We had to move. But it's no longer under the rent control rule. You convert it from residential property to commercial property. Maybe you start renting it out as storefronts or as a parking garage or as a warehouse or something like that. Or you find ways to cut costs. You quit hiring bonded workers to work on the plumbing and the electricity, and you just kind of do it yourself or you don't do it at all, right? And then 10 years goes by and the place gets condemned, and then the city actually closes it, and then nobody can live there. And then think about it long term. What happens if you're a developer that's thinking about investing your money in new apartment complexes? Are you going to build new apartment complexes in places where you know you can't make any money on it? No. So what's going to happen? You're going to end up with less housing that you were intending to protect than you had when you started. Now, that's the perfect illustration of the piety myth, because by ignoring economic reality, in this case supply and demand, and then implementing a policy, you actually do the opposite of what you wanted to do. You wanted to create an abundance of housing for lower income people. And you ended up creating a shortage of housing for those very people. And that's because, I'm sorry, but economic reality doesn't care about your feelings. And it really doesn't care about the feelings of municipal government. Supply and demand just is what it is. So the only question is whether you're going to have policies that accommodate economic reality or try to deny it. That's really the only question. That's the piety myth. And if you get that, that solves most of the problems. Second myth is the greed myth. Now, the greed myth is not the idea that people are greedy. All right? That's not a myth. Right? We are a fallen human race. Wherever two or three are gathered, no doubt, you're going to have some greed. The greed myth is the idea that a market economy, at its essence, is about greed. That literally, it's what it's about. It needs greed. It feeds greed. That's what it's about. And this is the really, really popular idea. There was a movie in 1987 called Wall Street with Michael Douglas. And there was actually a sequel a few years ago that's actually not a bad movie where it starts when he gets out of jail. But Michael Douglas in this movie is a character named Gordon Gekko. And he plays a sort of stereotypical Wall Street real estate trader with the stiff white collar and the cigar and everything. And there's a scene in the movie near the end where he is at a stockholders meeting. He's in a room kind of like this at a convention center. And he gets angry and he manages to get the microphone. And he gets up and he gives this speech. He says, "Greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed cuts through and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed in all its forms has marked the upward surge of mankind." Now, when you hear this, you think, is this supposed to be a climax? Am I supposed to get, chills or something here? I mean, this is not very inspiring. Now, let me tell you about the movie. The movie is written and produced by a guy named Oliver Stone. All right, so he's a well-known anti-American leftist. And so you think, okay, now I get it. He's creating this grotesque caricature of the business person, right? That's true. But here's the kind of slightly more depressing part, is the most widely read defender of capitalism in the 20th century made a very similar argument. Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand was a Soviet exile in the 1920s, moved here, changed her name to Ayn Rand. She ended up, started out on the East Coast, ended up in California working as a playwright, wrote a book called The Fountainhead, and then in 1957 she wrote a book called Atlas Shrugged that made her a sensation. She still sells several hundred thousand copies of her book sell every year. And I actually spent part of my senior year kind of transfixed with Rand because I was at a very liberal college and somebody told me about her. And I read a couple of books, and then I ended up with Atlas Shrugged, which is about that thick, reading it when I was supposed to be studying for a German final. So I no doubt this kind of shaped my trajectory a little bit. The problem is that Rand, her greatest genius was that she made entrepreneurs heroes. Try to think of novels in which the entrepreneur, the business person, is actually the hero as a business person. Just try to think of a movie or of a great literary work in which the business person is the good guy rather than the bad guy. There's very, very few examples. Batman doesn't count. Bruce Wayne is rich, but he's only a hero as Batman, right? He just happens to be a billionaire, right? About the only movie I can think of is It's a Wonderful Life, right? So very, very few. Well, it turns out Rand actually argued, she defended capitalism in terms of greed and selfishness. This is what was so strange. In fact, she said, capitalism and altruism are incompatible. They're philosophical opposites. They cannot coexist in the same man or the same society. Altruism is acting for the benefit of others. And she said, capitalism and altruism are incompatible. Now, you would think that was the claim of a socialist. She was a leading defender of capitalism who said this. Right? It's a very, very strange thing to say. She had a book called The Virtue of Selfishness. Right? Now, when I read this my senior year, I thought, on the one hand, I found some of her arguments so compelling, but as a Christian, I realized, okay, this is a big non-starter, right? Greed and selfishness is one of the seven deadly sins. If the essence of capitalism is greed and selfishness, what do we do? Now, I eventually got around to reading some other people. I read a book called Wealth and Poverty by a guy named George Gilder and some books by Michael Novak and people like that who convinced me that Rand actually had this deeply confused. In fact, if you look at what really successful entrepreneurs do, they maybe money is one of their motivations, but a really good entrepreneur is only successful in a market economy if he or she is able to anticipate the wants and needs of others, right? Anticipate what people would want if it were made or produced, a good or a service, and then they put their wealth at risk in pursuit of that vision, and if they succeed, they anticipate right, they might do well. If they guess wrong, they do poorly. Now, whatever that is, that's not the greed of the miser. That's a type of altruism. That's a type of activity in which you're acting with regard for other people. Think of that as sort of commercial altruism. But when people hear Rand's argument, they'll often say, well, no, but this is how the argument for capitalism has always been made. Adam Smith, the sort of founder, the first main defender of the free market economy in 1776, didn't he argue this? Adam Smith is a Scottish moral philosopher who wrote that book I mentioned a minute ago called The Wealth of Nations. So it was written in 1776, coincident with the founding, but the founders didn't read it because obviously it had just been written, right? And the book was essentially an argument for the benefits of trade and specialization of labor and focusing on your comparative advantage. He said that's where the wealth of nations come from. It doesn't come from trying to protect our wealth, but from being willing to put our wealth at risk in pursuit of particular visions. But Smith is famous for his argument for self-interest. In fact, he's often called the apostle of self-interest. And so when people hear Smith, they often read Ayn Rand back into Smith. And this is a very serious mistake. And so this is the most subtle and nuanced point I'm going to make the entire night. But I want you to see that what Adam Smith made a very, very important and very different argument from Ayn Rand. So most people have never actually read The Wealth of Nations because it's a really long, kind of boring book. I read it when I read the whole thing and his other book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments when I was working on Money, Greed, and God. They've seen a couple of his quotes. They hear about self-interest, and then there's this other idea, this metaphor for the market that he develops. Does anybody know what mental association, an invisible hand? The market is an invisible hand. That's really all anybody knows about Smith. So let me just focus on two representative quotes. And what I want you to see is what Smith said is not that greed is good or that virtue or selfishness is a virtue. So here's the first quote. Since it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. Right? Now, so let's let that sink in for a minute. Try to think what he's saying. Is he saying the butcher ought to be greedy and then things will be better off? Is he saying that, you know, if the brewer is really greedy and selfish, he'll, you know, grace will abound more fully or something like that? Or is he saying something else? Right? So just let that sit for a minute. Then look at this other quote that's sort of related to it. He actually only ever uses the term invisible hand twice in all of his existing writings. And here's one of these places. It says, in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity, business people are led by an invisible hand and thus, without intending it, without knowing it, advance the interest of the society. All right, now what is Smith saying here? To understand what he's saying, you've got to make a distinction between self-interest and selfishness. Notice he's not saying anything in that first quote about selfishness. He's just talking about the fact that the butcher and the brewer and the baker, the reason you can get your dinner from them is not because they're thinking how much they love you necessarily. It's not because they're visualizing world peace. The butcher may just need to buy his daughter braces, right? He may need to pay the rent. That makes sense that we're going to be mainly concerned with the things that are close to us. Your self-interest, that has to do with the things that are sort of close to you and that you have some kind of control over and that you're aware of. So if you're a father, your self-interest isn't just you, but your wife and your children and your neighbors. That's the range of your self-interest. Right, but we often get in our heads the idea that self-interest is somehow kind of a bad thing, a necessary evil. But every time you take a breath, every time you get a glass of water, eat 3 square meals a day, sleep 8 hours, study before a test, look both ways before you cross the street, pray for forgiveness, you're acting in your self-interest. Is that bad? Is that a necessary evil? Do you tell your kids, well, you know, it's terrible, but yeah, you really should brush your teeth because it's good for you. It's bad to be so self-interested. No, you spend 18 years trying to get your kids. Just be at least rationally self-interested, right? They're totally clueless about this. Right? That's not selfishness. That's how God made us. We're bodily creatures that need to drink, we need to breathe, we need to eat, we need shelter. And so it makes sense that we would primarily be responsible for those things. And if we have children, our children are our primary responsibility. That's what Smith's talking about when he's talking about self-interest. And his point is, in what he called the natural system of liberty, so a market economy with the rule of law, so the butcher can't steal from you without getting punished. He could try to sell you spoiled meat, but that would ruin his business because word would get out, especially in this age of Yelp, right? Would last only about 15 minutes. And so the butcher is, even in a normal market economy, right, can actually pursue the things he's interested in, his self-interest, his daughter's braces, the rent he needs to pay. And yet what will he do as a butcher? In order to get his daughter braces, he's going to have to provide meat at a price that you're willing to pay and a quality that you like, and to do it better than his competitors. He's going to have to act for your benefit in order to pursue his own self-interest. That was Smith's point, is that a market properly ordered with the rule of law channels people's legitimate self-interest into socially beneficial outcomes. So it's not the law of the jungle where the strong prey on and enslave the weak, right? It's not just everybody doing what they want to do. You've got to have a rule of law. And then a market channels self-interest. So that's the key point. So remember the difference between self-interest and selfishness, right? So this butcher here, right, again, he may just be thinking of his daughter's braces, but he's going to be a good butcher. That's going to motivate him to do that. But now notice the other quote where he is talking about selfishness. He says, in spite of their natural selfishness and rapacity. In fact, Smith never says anything nice about a business person in any of his writings. He had the same kind of snobby disdain for business and men of commerce that a lot of intellectuals have. But notice what he's saying. Is he saying because of their natural selfishness and rapacity, business people will be led by invisible hand? No, he says in spite of. In other words, even if the butcher wants to be greedy, even if greed is actually his motivation, if you got the incentive set up right with the right laws, what's the best way for him to feed his greed? By providing meat at a quality and a price that you're willing to pay and to do it better than his competitors. Right? So Smith's point is that a market economy, it doesn't need greed or selfishness, but rather it has the ability to channel both our legitimate self-interest and our vices into outcomes that are beneficial to others, or at least to do that much better than any other economic system that you can imagine. In socialism, which we'll talk about a little later, there's no motivation at all. If the government owns all the stores, there is no motivation for you to serve the customer. Your only motivation is to curry favor with the government regulator that tells you what to do. That's your only motive, right? But in a market economy, you're constantly thinking, how do I serve my customers? You see the difference? That is a completely different argument than saying greed is good. And if you get that, you'll get why the greed myth is not true. Yes, of course, greed is a universal. Whatever economic system we have, people are going to be greedy at least part of the time. The question is, people do different things depending upon different systems. Third myth is the zero-sum game myth. It's all downhill from here. All the hard stuff is actually happening. A zero-sum game myth in this case is about the nature of trade. It's actually three kinds of games, basically. This is depressing to realize that almost all games fall into one of three categories. So a zero-sum game is a win-lose game. And it just is a game in which the rules are set up so that in order for someone to win, somebody has to lose. The reason it's called zero-sum is it's like one plus minus one. So it sums to zero. So chess, checkers, baseball, basketball, football. Some of these games you can tie. But notice if there's a tie, nobody wins, right? If somebody wins, there has to be a loser. That's just how the rules are set up. So that's a zero-sum game. There's two other kinds of games. So win, lose, or zero-sum. There's the lose-lose game, which is where everybody that plays ends up worse off as a result of having played it. So we don't tend to play these games more than once. Like nuclear war in a confined space, right? You might do it once, and then you learn your lesson. So you get that. That's just everybody ends up worse off. But there's also a third kind of game, a win-win game. And a win-win game is a game where everyone ends up better off as a result of having played the game. It doesn't mean everybody ends up equally well off. That's one type of win-win game. But if everyone ends up better off as a result of playing, then it's win-win. And so to determine if you're in a win-win game, you don't compare yourself to your neighbor. You don't say, well, he's better off than I am. What you do is you compare yourself in that situation with your counterfactual self if you had not been in that situation, right? If you'd been in another society. And if you're better off, then you're actually in a win-win game. See how that works? So the question is, with respect to different types of trade, is trade always a zero-sum game? In which if somebody wins, somebody benefits, then somebody has to lose. This is a picture from the Occupy Wall Street movement, 2008 and 2009. Which contributed absolutely nothing to civilization except for the distinction between the 99% and the 1%. And the idea was that the rich 1% had sort of confiscated all the wealth and left everyone, like this guy, I guess, destitute and poor. He probably has a master's degree, but, you know, we won't talk about that. I actually figured out and knew the answer to this question when I was in the sixth grade, but I didn't realize it until I was about 40. Unfortunately, I played a game called the trading game, and I lived in a place kind of like Billings, but in Texas, where it was mostly warm, but then sometimes we had ice storms in the panhandle of Texas. And so you knew when the ice storms were coming, and we knew nothing of snow days. I never had a snow day growing up. It just didn't occur to people, I guess. What happened is you just had to stay in, so you didn't go out at recess if it was an ice storm outside. And so on this particular day, my teacher had apparently watched the news and had gone to the dollar store and bought a bunch of little toys, all cost the same amount. And then during recess, she passed out these toys one at a time, one to each kid in the classroom. And they're all different. So things like a paddle board and a little silly putty egg and a deck of Barbie trading cards, things like that. And she passed them out at random. And he said, now look around, look at your toy, look at everyone else's toy. And then I want you to write down on a piece of paper between 1 and 10 how much you like the toy. It's totally up to you. But if you don't like it at all, it's a 1. If you love it, it's a 10. So we all wrote it down. All right? And then she said, all right, now tell me what your score was. So each of us called out our number, and she added up the total, and she wrote it on the board. So think of this as the kind of sum total of our satisfaction with our toy situation, all right? Now imagine this as 5 rows of 5 kids. I didn't count, but that was sort of, but this really simplifies it. So 5 rows of 5 kids. And so she said, okay, on the first round of the game, you can freely trade your toy with anyone else in the classroom. All right, so that meant we had four potential trading partners on the first trade. So some toys traded hands, but it wasn't a lot of activity, but you can only trade within your row. So a few toys traded hands, and they just said, okay, now write down how much you like the toy that you have in your hand. So again, we wrote down the number on a piece of paper. Then again, we called out the numbers, she added up the total, and she wrote it on the board. Guess what happened? The number went up. Now this is weird. Same kids, same toys, right? But the number went up. All right, now the reason I remember this all these years later is because of the second round of the game. She said, you can freely trade with anyone else in the classroom. Now at this point, it's mass pandemonium because that means everybody has 24 potential trading partners on the first trade. And there were no rules about multiple trades. So you could trade as many times as you possibly could. So suddenly kids are just trading all sorts of complex trigonometric calculations to figure out, you know, how to get rid of the Barbie trading cards to get the paddle ball, just all this kind of stuff. So it went on for several minutes. And so finally there were no trades left. Settled down. She said, okay, now write down the toy that you have in your hand, how much you like it between 1 and 10. So we did it again. She had us call out her numbers. She added up the total and she wrote it on the board. And you know what happened. Number went way up. Now, what is happening here? The great science fiction writer, an atheist and socialist, Isaac Asimov, talked about this kind of scenario in the market. He said, some people claim to understand it, but I think it's all nonsense. You think there must be some trick here, but there actually isn't a trick. What's happening is that there is a system of rules that's in place that channels the kinds of activities that people can do. Notice the teacher said, you can freely trade with anyone else, either in your row or in your classroom. That means I couldn't threaten the little girl behind me, right? You're gonna give me the silly putty and take the Barbie trading cards, I'm gonna get you out on the playground, right? That's not a free trade, right? That's coercion, that's theft, right? It would be battery probably too, or some other crimes I don't know about, right? But of course there was a rule of law. Now we didn't think of it, but there was a principal. By the way, when I was in the sixth grade, you got swats if you went to the principal's office. That existed then, right? So there was a rule of law. The teacher was there. We had all partially kind of had the rule of law inscribed on our hearts imperfectly, right? So we were partially self-governed and knew we can't do that. And so what do? Well, you try to find kids that are willing to trade. And so a trade under those circumstances is only going to happen if both trading partners perceive themselves as better off as a result. If it's mutually beneficial, right? If it's win-win. Notice when you trade with someone, you're not trading for equal things. Because if you, let's say I have groceries and I'm a grocer and you have money, right? And you're willing to pay $20 and we actually agree that these things are equal in value. We're never going to trade hands. The only reason you can go into a grocery store and show up with some money and buy groceries and then you leave with the groceries, right, and the grocer keeps the money, is because you wanted the groceries more than you wanted the money, and the grocer wanted the money more than he wanted the groceries. That is a market economy in microcosm right there. And notice that doesn't happen in the law of nature. That doesn't happen in the jungle, all right? That only happens in a very specific society and civilization with rules in place that then set up these type of exchanges. That is a remarkable thing. Lord Acton, a 19th century British statesman, said, liberty is the delicate fruit of a mature civilization. It's hard won and it's easy to lose, but that's what he's talking about. And that's the golden mean. A lot of sort of freshmen and sophomores in college will say this. They'll say, well, what we want is some kind of political economy that's sort of midway between capitalism and socialism. And then you ask them what it means, and it always kind of sounds like socialism. But that's not actually the relevant spectrum. The relevant spectrum of social orders would be, on the one hand, anarchy. Anarchy is just where there is no rule of law at all. The law of the jungle, the strong prey on and enslave the weak. That's on one end. And statism is on the other end, where the government, coercive power of the government, is in every single aspect of your lives, not only between employer and employee, but between mother and father, husband and wife, teacher and student, right? That's the spectrum. Economic freedom exists where there is a functioning government and rule of law, but it is limited and restricted to its jurisdiction, and then that sets up a wide sort of domain for people to engage in mutually beneficial interactions. That's free enterprise, and that's what you want. Then the final myth, very briefly, is actually related to the zero-sum game myth. Called the materialist myth. If the zero-sum game myth treats trade as if it always has a winner and a loser, the materialist myth is a myth about wealth. And it's the idea that wealth is not created, it's merely transferred. Right? So like you hear about someone getting more than their fair share. Right? That implies that the economy or the amount of wealth in the economy is this fixed amount. Right? It's like a pot of gold. Some people got more and that left less for everybody else. That presupposes a particular vision about the nature of wealth and economy. The pie is usually the way that it's described, right? If somebody got more than their fair share, a larger slice of the pie than everybody else. Now, what is, think about a pie, right? A pie, once you cook it, right, it just is there. It doesn't get larger, right? It doesn't grow. If you bake a cherry pie like this and you invite 7 friends over, right, if you haven't sliced it, before they get there, the best you can do is slice it into 8 equal slices, right? If you don't do that, right, let's say you want to eat a quarter of the pie, you're not going to do that when people are there, right? Because there's going to be less for everybody else. But that's because it's a fixed amount. It's a finite amount, right? And so in that case, if somebody makes more, that means they've caused somebody else to make less. But is that how real market economies work? Oh, of course not. Any economist will tell you that over time there can be recessions and depressions, but the economy grows. The amount of wealth actually increases. The late Steve Jobs didn't get rich selling iPhones to homeless people or stealing them from homeless people. He actually did get rich selling them to homeless people in Seattle. I can testify to that, right? But those iPhones weren't already out there, right? He participated in a process of wealth creation and actually grew the total amount of wealth that was available. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible, economists know this, but as Christians, we should expect something like this. Because remember, human beings, we're not just sort of ghosts stuck in bodies, and we're not just apes come down from the trees. We're creatures made in the image of the creative God, a unique hybrid of the material and the spiritual, the intersection of the material and the spiritual. God creates the world, and then he creates us in his image. And so this God who exercises this sovereign freedom and creativity. He creates the sand, then he leaves it to us to create fiber optic cables and computer chips based in silica. He could have made those directly. Instead, he decided to create a world in which we get to participate in this creative activity. We don't create from nothing like God does, of course. We take what he's made and create new things. So under certain economic conditions, with the rule of law, private property, limited government, and economic freedom, though that type of system maximizes our ability both to pursue our own self-interest and channels even our vices and channels our creative capacity to create wealth that was not there before. There's really only one system that does that. It's called free enterprise. Thank you very much.